Here's a poem by Mary Oliver, The Journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Welcome to my podcast, Hints and Guesses. Kent here. I'm offering another shorter episode, which I'm calling Eat This Scroll, where we turn to a poem, a prayer, a passage that's been particularly meaningful to me. And I hope you hear a hint, a guess, a clue, something for your own wild unfolding. And, you know, sometimes I have a feeling that the most important question is not what does a poem mean. You know, often, you know, that's the question of the rational mind in a way, and sometimes it's important, but really I'm often asking, how does a poem work? And this is one of those poems that has been working on me and really, really turned my life inside out. And it came back into my mind recently in kind of a strange way. I had a dream just about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, just before I left for Joshua Tree. I was guiding a program for Animus there. And I had the following dream. I'm preparing for a sermon. I'm at home, I believe, and I don't really want to prepare, and like that kind of feeling of procrastination is present, and or kind of the feeling like I'll get to it when I get to it, and I realize I'm late. And I hurry to the church, and it's not a church I recognize. It kind of reminds me, now that I'm saying it, of my childhood church, which was called Thomas Road Baptist Church, and, you know, kind of pews and tiered seating and a big, huge stage and white columns. It's that kind of place. And when I arrive, I realize I don't have any notes. Either I didn't prepare, or whatever I did prepare, I left at home, and I don't remember. I don't even know where to begin, and I'm starting to get kind of that panicky feeling of, what am I going to say? And the service has already started. I think there's maybe music going on, and it won't be long. And I guess the first thing, which is sort of telling of the modern psyche, I'm trying to look something up on my phone. You know, maybe I can find something to talk about on my phone, or at one point I'm trying to look up this church to find out what the gospel passage is, because I think if I knew the passage, I could find a place to start, but I can't think of anything and my phone won't work. And at this point, oddly enough, I'm kind of being driven around in a little golf cart, and I'm kind of too far away from the stage to even hear what's going on, because this is another idea I have. I'll just tune in to what's happening, and I'll kind of use that and ride that wave, but I'm too far away. And then I look and I see that David White is giving the opening meditation, and I'm supposed to follow him. And I have this terrible, sick feeling of how the hell am I supposed to follow David White? You know, it's kind of a pretentious dream in a way. But that's the feeling, and all I can think of is one line from this poem. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. And I'm like, okay, I'll just start with the poem. And I'm trying my phone again because I can't remember the whole thing. But my phone won't load. And I can see that he's finished now. And I don't want to go up. And I wait a little too long. And people are starting to file out. And finally, I'm just on the stage. And I look out and people are looking at me. And they're kind of like, some of them are turning toward me. Some of them are kind of half turned away as if they're trying to decide should they stay or not. And I just start with this opening line. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. And people are kind of shifting a bit and some are sitting down. And David White returns to the stage and he puts a map in front of me of Scotland. And he wants to talk to me about Scotland. And I'm trying to like give him a look that I need to get going on this. This is interesting. But he's showing me the west coast of Scotland. There are like five or six villages. And he's explaining, this is where I'm really from. And I'm interested in the east coast of Ireland. Like, I want to have this conversation. I'm from the east coast of Ireland, the place where the causeways touch Scotland and Ireland. And there's some kind of like, there's something passing between us that has to do with place and geography and culture, but this is not the right time. And I kind of like, almost like I don't push him aside, but I can't really discuss. And I try to go to the next line. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. And I have a feeling that whatever this poem is about is not other than whatever the Gospels are about or like the whole narrative of faith, if there's such a thing, or the sort of the grand story of the Bible itself is not other than this poem, which I'm not sure what to make of that just now as I'm saying that. And like, I'm wondering, am I trying to make something work? But the feeling is more simple. It's like, let me see if I can feel the feeling. It's like, there's truth here and I just have to relax. That's kind of the feeling. And then I wake up. You know, strangely, as life is just strange, this trip to Joshua Tree with Animus came about kind of last minute, and my stuff, my books and poems and clothes and whatever are still mostly in boxes because our life here in Georgia is far from settled. I flew to Joshua Tree, flew to California and drove to Joshua Tree and I didn't have my usual bag of tricks. And I didn't really think of this poem kind of in an analogous way until I was there and until we were sitting down and beginning to open up the program and just feeling my own kind of nakedness. And I didn't have my bag of tricks, meaning I have folders of poems and notes on Wild Mind stuff and just from my years of guiding this kind of program. And I don't know, I just felt like, yep, this seems exactly right. And it's almost as if the dream was ahead of me in some way. And I did end up using this poem as just part of talking about what it is that we're up to and the invitation. And so I don't know, I want to just make a few comments about this poem. And in fact, I don't want to say a ton about it, but maybe just a few things that are turning over for me now. Maybe a little bit of how this poem came into my sort of, I was going to say consciousness, but it sounds kind of too fancy. Just, I became aware of it and it started to break me down and a little of what I'm hearing now. And then I'll read the poem again and we'll just leave it at that. I first really heard this poem, sort of, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear," when I was a pastor and when I was at Mars Hill. And, you know, I was in the midst of some real unraveling. You know, much of that I've written about in Bitten by a Camel, at least bits and pieces. And this particular poem just started wearing me down. I wrote it on my whiteboard, in fact, in my office. And every day I would read it. There were some days when I didn't even want to read it. Like, it would be over there in the corner and I would feel like, I don't know. It was like a bell that just kept ringing in the night. And to a certain extent, it was just the opening line that did it for me. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what a beginning would look like. You know, I had all the things that the first half of life promised, like a job and a family and an education and a quote name and, you know, a lever and a place to stand, you know, the kind of, maybe some of the most important things that we live into in the first half, to use that image, that metaphor from Jung. And there, this creeping lostness, this sinking feeling that I hadn't really even started. And that's what I felt with this opening line. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. And I didn't want to become a beginner again. Who wants to begin again? Even though I knew all the lines, you know, unless you change, become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. I knew about the Buddhist's beginner mind, that the wise person begins each day. And, you know, I can quote stuff all day long, you know. And in fact, it was like I was sailing a ship of quotations lost at sea, you know. I had a quotation for everything and I had a passage for everything. And like this dream is pointing out, who are you without this crutch, you know? And I don't know, for me, there needed to be a certain amount of diminishment and courage. Courage meaning from the heart, just to take the small step, take the step close in, to use David White's line, take the step you don't want to take, he says. And humility, like real humility. I think, you know, in spiritual circles, humility often looks like deferring to someone else. But that's not the way I see it. Humility mean, you know, it really comes from humus, from the earth, and to be earthy and to just be real and to say, I know what I'm doing to a certain extent and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm going to take this step. And the moment you do, the voices around you begin shouting. One day you finally knew what you had to do and you began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble and you felt that old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. This is that kind of inner and outer cacophony of voices that say, stay small, stay the same, don't change. If you do this, your life will be over. You'll end up living in a van down by the river. You won't be able to make a living. You won't be loved. You won't be accepted. For me, you'll look stupid. That's one of the kind of wounding arrows. And they're inner and outer. Mend my life. Fix me. Save me. That line gets real blurry. And from an inner point of view, these are our inner protectors. You know, that's the phrase I like. Sometimes we call them subpersonalities or complexes from Jung. And also that's in the Wild Mind model from Bill Plotkin's book, Subpersonalities. But I love the phrase inner protectors, and that's exactly what they're up to. They're trying to keep us safe by keeping us small. That's the main strategy. All these the loyal soldier, the wounded child, the escapist, the addict, you know. Stay safe by staying small. In fact, James Hollis says, perhaps the biggest shadow of all is that we live lives that are too small for us. And this cacophony of inner voices keeps us small by keeping us safe. And that works until it doesn't, you know. And I just was feeling that, not only at this time in my life, but for some reason it's coming back up again. You know, here we are, and here I am, and these voices haven't exactly been laid to rest, and they never will. You know, these clever strategies don't give up easily, and so it takes a certain amount of heart and courage and humility just to keep going. She says, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It is absolutely terrible to disappoint those external voices that want to keep us small and those inner voices that want to keep us safe. It was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. You know, this was kind of, I remember feeling, you know, shouldn't have I, and I feel this now, like, you know, I've done all this work, you know, I've worked on my inner life, you know, and why so late in life, you know, why couldn't have I have started all this in my 20s? And I don't know the answer to that. I just didn't, and I couldn't, and I wasn't ready enough. And then she says, but little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world. And for me, at least, this is such a lovely and poetic expression for what we mean by soul, like our own unique way of being, the inner constellation that is us. And it doesn't come to us as a sudden and complete revelation. You know, we don't bump into it all of a sudden and know it completely, or we don't say, I'm never going to give up on this inner voice, you know, as if we know what that is, or we don't say, I'm choosing authenticity from this point on. No, it's slowly. Slowly the stars begin to burn through the sheets of clouds. And actually, that single image is often what I use to describe the soul. It's kind of like a constellation in the night sky, and you come to recognize the way in which these parts are constellated. You know, these subtle clues about who we are that our little points, our little stars that are related. There's kind of a relational image that begins to burn through the sheets of clouds, and it feels a little like coming back home to your own voice. And it's like you start speaking, you're like, who is that? And that's like the deepest sense of a word like vocation, which comes from Vox. I think we all long to sing our song, to speak in our truest voice. And then she ends the poem by saying, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save, which is your own. One day you finally knew what you had to do and you began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough in a wild night, in the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save.